It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now we examine aerial surveillance technology and other spy capabilities in our skies following the Chinese launch balloon that wandered across the continental U.S., was shot down 2 weeks ago off the coast of South Carolina. Call it with your questions about aerial surveillance, about information gathering, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Arthur Holland Michel is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs, author of Eyes in the Sky. Arthur, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Good morning. And President Biden yesterday made his first formal remarks on those three mysterious objects shot down in American airspace in recent days, saying they're likely for research, not spycraft, unlike the Chinese spy balloon shot down. How common are these unidentified flying objects?
A lot more common than we might like to think. I've studied mysterious things that operate in the airspace for years now. I started looking at drones about a decade ago. And I, unlike perhaps most people who don't have to spend their days thinking about these things, I'm aware that the skies are a lot more crowded than we think. There's all sorts of things up there, and a lot of it is there for a wide variety of reasons. And the issue is that because the airspace is so large and there are so many different people that can get, you know, their aircraft into the sky, be they balloons or drones or other kinds of things, it's hard to know what they're doing there, what the purposes are. And the sky is getting a lot more crowded as well, which is, I think, another issue that we're dealing with here.
Biden mentioned efforts like the Navy's Unidentified Aerial Phenomena Task Force working to catalog or inventory all of the remote-controlled airborne objects. How major of a documentation lift would that be?
Part of the issue here is that there may be something that is, you know, in statistics and psychology referred to as a frequency illusion, which is that, you know, once you notice something the first time, you start noticing it a lot more. I'm sure, you know, everyone who's listening has had this experience.
Mm-hmm.
Partly, I think what's going to be happening with this task force is that they're going to be noticing things that maybe shouldn't necessarily be of interest, in addition to wising up to the fact that maybe we're being watched a lot more than we previously thought, which is absolutely a possibility. I think this balloon has also pierced our sense of security that we are the only ones that have sort of command of our skies. I think we've got to catch up to the reality that that's no longer the case.
And we heard that this week unfolding, you know, China claiming, well, in this tit for tat between the U.S. and China here, I mean, they're saying, look, you know, Chinese airspace, you Americans have been there more than 10 times since the start of 2022. Mm. And the U.S. is like, no, we have.
Yeah.
So what do you see there, even on a level among other nations as well, multilaterally?
Well, so not only has this whole incident sort of pierced our illusion that, you know, the skies are pretty empty, it's also given us a kind of candid look into this world of intelligence collection that happens among major powers, usually in secret, you know. And there's something really interesting that happens when, a country, say like the U.S., flies something over or near China. If China detects it, they'll probably keep that a secret because they don't want to show their hand. They don't want, you know, the U.S. to know that is happening. So this has kind of pulled the veil off all of that. There's a lot of secrecy that goes in both directions, and all sorts of countries are looking at each other, and we don't know who knows what and how they know it and when they found it out. So this is a really interesting opportunity to see the inner workings of what's happening sort of all the time. But it's a fair point. All major powers are constantly looking at each other, be it through the air or through cyber or through human informants. A lot of this is going on. We just don't usually know about it.
What about the advantage of using spy drones versus balloons versus satellites, the specific type of technology here?
Every aerial technology has its pros and cons. Mm-hmm. A drone is going to be very inexpensive, but it's not going to be able to fly for a very long time. A balloon is going to be a little more expensive, but still pretty cheap. It's going to be able to fly for a really long time, but you're not going to have much control necessarily over where it goes. And you might not be able to keep it over a certain specific spot on the ground for a really long time. A satellite, is very powerful, stays up there for a very long time, but it's extraordinarily expensive. And it may only revisit certain spots on the Earth, in a pretty infrequent way. Mm. So you've got to balance all of those sort of factors.
Pros and cons.
Yeah. To decide what is the optimal, it's a weird word to use for this, but optimal sort of aerial collection device for your purposes.
Arthur Holland Michelle, researcher specializing in surveillance systems and drones, these unmanned systems. Call in 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We are discussing these remote-controlled aerial spy technology, the future of balloon espionage programs following the American military shooting down China's infamous spy balloon 2 weeks ago off the coast of South Carolina. Call in 800-642-1234 to talk. We have Arthur Holland Michelle, Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs, stays with us. Let's bring on a call, Phil in Mount Horeb. Phil, what's on your mind?
Thank you for taking my call. I'm curious. There seems to be something of a national debate or dissension in the ranks regarding our authority to shoot down foreign objects from countries that maybe have negative interest towards us. I don't understand this flap. I am wondering where it is coming from, and I'm hoping that your guest speaker can speak to that. We have no obligation to tolerate those objects over our airspace. Gary Powers, U2 flap, the whole thing, it's been on for decades. What's the problem?
Phil, thank you. Go ahead, Arthur.
Thanks, Phil. It's a great question. It's a little bit of a tricky one because you obviously want to have some rules around airspace because the airspace is in some regards a collective space, for things like international air travel, and scientific research. You do need to have some rules to prevent it from just being a total wild west. And that goes both ways. There have to be rules preventing, the inappropriate use of aircraft. And there also have to be rules preventing the inappropriate, shooting down of objects. The reason that there is a debate around the balloon and the reason it's a particularly tricky debate is because it doesn't have any humans on board. And that makes all of the difference. If there are humans aboard, that changes the calculus. Because there aren't humans aboard, there is an argument that can be made that shooting it down is actually more dangerous than leaving it up there for a couple of reasons. One, the missiles can miss, as one of the missiles over Lake Huron did for one of these other objects that were shot down. The pieces can fall to the ground and potentially hurt people. But also it risks causing escalation, which is potentially dangerous between two major powers who are already kind of at loggerheads with each other. So that's sort of the contours of the debate. It's not quite as black and white as one might hope, because of course it is very scary when these things fly over our head.
Can we probe that a little further? Because President Biden said the U.S. is not looking for a new Cold War with China. How could a situation like this shoot down escalate?
Well, these things are very delicate. I think part of the thing about the balloon is that it is a provocation, but it is not necessarily a provocation that would go as so far as say flying a manned fighter jet or a human crewed inhabited spy plane over US airspace. But escalation, you know, goes both ways. And there's a lot of unpredictability in escalation, and the nature of escalation is such that this unpredictability feeds off of itself. So, you know, every time that there is a decision that maybe seems calculated on one side, the other side, may respond to that in a way that expands this total unpredictability. The key being, and this has been a really important point that has come out of all of this whole fiasco, is that there needs to be better communication between the United States and China about these things. There have to be open lines where, you know, people on both sides can pick up the phone and say, look, I know this is embarrassing, or this is complicated, or this is an inconvenient truth, but we need to talk about it and figure it out, instead of trading blows, you know, by just making media comments, for example, or by, you know, shooting each other's objects down out of the sky.
Are you confident in our last few moments together that communication with China will improve? I mean, we see our Secretary of State, headed into talks perhaps once again.
Yeah, I am hopeful. We have no choice but to be hopeful about these things, because the alternative is just too unbearable. And I think that this balloon incident could be a really useful learning moment. Mm. Again, it was just a balloon. There weren't any humans on board. So now we look at it, we say, okay, yeah, this could have been really, really bad. This could have gotten really, really dangerous.
We are out of time. Thank you for joining us, Arthur. No, that's okay. Arthur Holland-Michel, Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Snowy owls are captivating. Big birds living up to their snowy white name. But fewer sightings are being reported in Wisconsin this winter, and we ask why. Call in with your questions about snowies, your sighting experiences. Welcome, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ryan Brady is a Natural Heritage Conservation Program biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Ryan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Well, tell us what your numbers are saying here in terms of sightings with snowy owls.
Well, as you mentioned, sightings are down this year compared to most recent years. We've only had a few dozen sightings around the state, somewhere in the 30s or so, compared to this time last year when there were over 140 different owls that were spotted. And in some of our really active years over the past decade, we've had several hundred seen at this point in the winter. And that's a pattern that's not just consistent in Wisconsin, but also throughout most of the lower 48 this year.
So we naturally ask, what causes snowy owl populations to fluctuate then?
Well, snowy owl numbers in any given year really depend a lot on a small rodent called a lemming. Think of it like a supersized mouse or vole found in the Canadian Arctic where the snowy owl nests. And the snowy owl nesting success will vary depending on the numbers of those lemmings, which can vary themselves from year to year. So in summers when lemming numbers are high, the owls will produce many babies, and those babies will ultimately leave the nest and disperse south, and that leads to what we call eruption years here in Wisconsin. When the lemming numbers are low, the owls don't raise very many babies. Some won't even nest at all because there isn't a good food source to feed them. And that means there's far fewer owls on the landscape to move south during the wintertime. So this particular year, although we don't have great data on lemmings from northern Canada, it appears that the lemming numbers were very low across a wide swath of the breeding range. That led to low nest success in productivity, which means fewer owls to move south.
So you mentioned eruption, where larger than usual numbers of birds come our way. Are snowies prone to these eruption tendencies?
Yes, we see eruptions periodically. It's not a hard and fast rule, but somewhere around every 4 years. And sometimes you get a back-to-back eruption. But in that 3 to 5 year range is when we tend to see them. So the last one we saw was, last year was kind of a moderate one. Prior to that was 2017. And then prior to that was 2013 and 14. So you can see that kind of periodicity to it. And that's related to the periodicity of the lemming numbers. The lemmings build in numbers over a few years and then ultimately crash in population. And the owl populations follow suit.
Are lemming populations being affected by climate change? Is that an issue?
Yeah, good question. Good question. As you can imagine, where these birds spend their summers are remote areas, very difficult to access. There's not a lot of research going on. So there hasn't been a great deal of work to pinpoint the extent of the impacts on lemming populations, particularly here in North America. And so we think that these lemming cycles may be disrupted by climate change, but we don't know that at this point. Snowy owls, especially during the summer, not very well known. And as such, that's a bit of a barrier to kind of developing conservation strategies for a species that has declined 50% or so in the last half century.
Okay, need more research there. We heard from Jeff in Delafield, called in to ask, do wind turbines have an effect on snowy owls or any owl populations for that matter?
At this time, we don't know of any wide-scale effects of wind turbines. Certainly, there are cases of owls flying into wind turbines, and so there is a small degree of mortality associated with them. Mm-hmm. But we don't have any evidence at this point that they are a major player with most owls. With that said, collisions with different types of structures are one of the primary threats for snowy owls. Airplanes, vehicles, other types of infrastructure, communication towers, wires, things like that can be a big problem here on the wintering grounds, obviously less so farther north where there's less development.
Can you just stop for a moment and just expand on the enormous geographic territory these snowy owls cover?
Well, it's a species that's distributed globally in across the Arctic during the summer and then move south during the winter. And they can cover thousands of miles. They're very nomadic. During the summer, they might be homebodies, if you will, if they found a good stash of lemmings somewhere. But if there isn't a good food source, they're really moving around. And so they can cover thousands of miles in the course of 1 year, and not just north to south, but also east to west. Some birds that have spent time here in Wisconsin may end up even over in Russia, crossing over the Bering Sea. So they're very well suited to move around looking for a dynamic prey source.
They know how to adapt, sounds like. Talking about snowy owls with DNR conservation biologist Ryan Brady, you can join in at 800-642-1234. So Ryan, where is the best place to look for a snowy owl? How do we go about doing that?
In general, their habitat is open country. So you want to go to open habitats like grassland, wetland complexes. Airports actually are mimic the tundra in a way because they're treeless and wide open. So they do tend to attract snowies, which can be an issue. But those are the types of habitats you want to visit. Head on out any time of day, really, but your best chances are at dawn and dusk. To find them. Now, specifically this year, we don't have many owls around. There's only a few hot spots. There's a few birds around the airport in Superior in the northwest corner, Crex Meadow State Wildlife Area, which is a great destination for just about anything, has a few snowy owls this year. And then there's a good swath of owls kind of running in the southeast quarter of the state. from Green Bay down through the Freedom area, Green Lake County, into the northern part of Dane County. So if you go to eBird.org, you can find a map that will show recent sightings, and you might be able to go find one yourself.
You mentioned eBird, and wondering just about the efforts around citizen science and these crowdfunded research projects. What is that helpful to you as a conservation biologist?
Oh, absolutely. Extremely valuable. eBird has been instrumental in providing data on bird populations, both in distribution, but also density and change over at least a short time period, because eBird's relatively new. Great example, we recently completed the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas Project. We're in the process of finalizing the results and working on a publication for that. But that utilized thousands of citizen scientists all across the state to accomplish something we would never have otherwise been able to do. And that is cover a lot of ground in a short period of time to document all the nesting birds across the state during the breeding season. So there's a lot of power, especially if you live in a place that's somewhat low populated, where you can make contributions that aren't being made in places like Madison and Milwaukee and such that have a lot of contributions already.
What are the biggest threats in Wisconsin facing migratory birds?
Well, facing migratory birds in general, that's probably a little bit different than the threats facing snowy owls. Mm-hmm. For migratory birds in general, I mean, well, all birds, it's loss of habitat is the most critical factor. Beyond that, there's a couple key things, and one of them is collisions with windows and other types of, you know, like we talked about before, communication towers, other structures. And it's not just windows, it's sky-rise buildings and, you know, big cities and such where you might have large numbers hit in one kill. It's the 5 or 6 or 10 birds that might hit a window at residential homes too. The cumulative impact is huge. And then believe it or not, outdoor cats, free ranging cats have significant impact, to the point of, you know, over a billion birds per year causing mortality on native bird populations.
That's really significant. And so in terms of wrangling cats, keeping them indoors is really important here for the bird population.
It is. It's a contentious issue. We all love cats. The reality is they're not native predators in our ecosystems, and they're having a significant impact on bird populations. But like I said, that is an issue that has been difficult to tackle for a variety of reasons, but cats indoors if you can.
Is there, as we close here in just a few moments, is there a migratory bird you're excited to see this spring?
Oh, I'm always excited to see anyone that's next to arrive. The spring is such a wonderful time to just constantly see new things day after day. And so far, we've already had some sandhill cranes arriving in southeast Wisconsin. You red-winged blackbirds trickling in. We've got eagles starting the nest, and great horned owls are already on eggs probably. And if you're in the north, you know, you might be seeing some trumpeter swans starting to trickle back, and birds are starting to sing again. So it's a wonderful time of year if you're a bird watcher expert or just kind of casual backyard watcher alike.
Ryan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ryan Brady is a Natural Heritage Conservation Program biologist with the Wisconsin DNR. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.